I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama and Governor Romney are both in Ohio today offering two very different visions for fixing the U.S. economy. Obama is speaking at a community college in Cleveland while Romney is at a manufacturing company in Cincinnati. The race is heated up and the rhetoric is getting more negative and nasty, and this is just June. Wait until the campaigns swing into high gear after Labor Day. This promises to be the most expensive presidential election yet, fueled in part by super PAC money. There is much at stake this year, including how to get more people into the workforce, concerns about the euro, a crisis brewing in Syria, and partisan battles in Congress about regulation and taxes and spending and more. Well, today on Radio Times, we want to take stock of the race to the White House, and we have two guests who have joined us. Joining us by telephone is Scott Huffman. He's an associate professor of political science and director of the Social and Behavioral Research Lab at Winthrop University, and that's in Rock Hill, South Carolina. He also directs the Winthrop ETV Poll Initiative, collecting data about how the American South feels about political developments. And Scott, always a pleasure. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. It's great to be with you again.
Also with us is Molly Ball. She's a staff writer. She covers national politics at The Atlantic. In fact, joins us from their studios. And Molly, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here, Marty.
Molly, let me begin with you. And I talked about gearing up and getting ready for a nasty campaign. Are we just at the very beginnings of what will be a particularly nasty campaign season?
Yeah, I don't think either side in this campaign has shown any compunction about being willing to go on the attack as sort of rabidly as possible. And I think that's because each of these campaigns believes that it is incumbent upon them to make it about the other guy. Romney's campaign has said from the beginning that he wins by making it a referendum on Obama and keeping the focus there, and that means reminding people as relentlessly as possible of all the reasons they have to be dissatisfied with or upset at the president. And the president realizes that that referendum on him alone would be difficult for him to win, and so he has to turn it around and make it a choice instead, a choice between him and someone that he hopes to paint as an even more unappealing alternative.
What we're witnessing are these quick response teams, so that one small gaffe gets caught, gets turned into an ad, and gets highlighted.
Right, and you do hear some criticism of this.
Yes.
From beltway poobahs, I suppose, who say, oh, well, where's the lofty vision? Where's the sense of being above all of this? Where, especially in the case of the president, is the sort of dignity of the office? Instead, it's very much down in the trenches, down in the mud, not missing any opportunity to mount an attack, no matter how trivial. I think the campaigns believe, first of all, that in this day and age of social media and cable TV and micro-controversies and in an election that's likely to be very close, you don't want to let anything go unanswered, and you want to exploit every tiny marginal potential edge for all it's worth. And also just that's the way this is going to be. You know, this is a campaign that's going to just be full of charges and countercharges from both sides.
And Scott, is that a bad thing to have a nasty kind of smash mouth campaign season?
Well, Molly's right. There is absolutely nothing that's going to be too petty for either side to go after. And there's a plus side and a minus side too. The minus side is it kind of is terrible for all of us to have to listen to a very long negative campaign. Negative campaigns traditionally can depress voting, can depress enthusiasm among voters. But on the flip side, what they're hoping to do is energize their base. And a lot of the negative sniping is aimed at directly that. It's not really aimed at converting people who might be marginal supporters of your opponent, not even really aimed at converting the so-called independents, which is mostly a myth about how much they swing elections. It's really about firing up your base, because what research has shown, Drew Weston, for example, did a lot of research where he put people in fMRI machines and watched their brains as they were thinking politically. And two things make a partisan very happy. One is when they hear negative things about the opponent. That really, really makes them happy. The only thing that makes them happier is, by the way, not hearing good things about their guy, is when they hear attacks on their guy, reasoning it away, saying, oh, well, that's BS. That's simply not true. So what you're doing with this constant, petty, often annoying sniping is really charging up your base, and that's how elections are won and lost, by whether or not you get your base out to vote. And while it's annoying for the rest of us, it serves a purpose for them.
But do you also think, Scott, that the press plays into that, and if there is a gaffe or some misstep, it gets magnified and replayed over and over and over, especially on cable?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that. It makes for a great story. It's very amusing. You know, the news channels have seen how incredibly popular things like The Daily Show, which play on gaps. And by the way, research also shows that watchers of The Daily Show are better informed about many issues than watchers of the cable news networks. But they've seen how this plays out, that it makes for great, compelling story. It's very interesting. It's got all the classics of a good news story that's going to get eyeballs on pages with ads around the margins, which is really what they need.
And I should also, it was NPR listeners and Daily Show watchers, I think, that came out on top on that study. Molly, back to you. And we also have just, you know, mountains, shovelfuls of money being spent, and we're again just at the beginning of this election season, and we see the super PAC money. I said in the intro, it's probably going to be the most expensive election yet. What are the problems with that, do you think?
Well, it means that if you live in a swing state, you should probably just get rid of your television right now.
Right. Or keep it turned off, right?
Right. I mean, one of the things that I actually wonder about this election, where you potentially have $1 billion being spent on each side, right, is how much is it possible to even spend that much money on an election? You know, I mean, at some point you've bought all of the TV airtime you possibly can. If you wanted to, you could buy your own television station. People's mailboxes are full and they're ignoring all of this stuff as well. And then you have the mobilization in the field, all of the campaign offices that are opening, and all of the turnout, that the get out the vote stuff that gets done. And I just wonder if at some point there's nothing else you can do short of just paying people to vote, which I think is technically illegal, although it feels like we come close sometimes. But yeah, that's absolutely going to have a big impact. The Obama campaign is now convinced that they will be outspent, which 4 years ago would have been a mind-boggling notion. 4 years ago, the Obama campaign, outspent the McCain campaign by a vast proportion, but we're now in this new campaign finance landscape where someone like Sheldon Adelson, the casino magnate in Las Vegas, is making noises of spending $100 million on the presidential election, and you have the Koch brothers saying they're going to spend $200 million, the American Crossroads, Karl Rove's group, saying they're going to spend $300 million, and this will all be aimed at different targets, perhaps. I think a lot of it will be devoted to the Senate races and the House races. But the on the left, you don't have the same super PAC and big donor infrastructure. And so most of that money is going to have to come from the Obama campaign and the DNC itself, which makes it easier to coordinate the messaging, possibly, but also harder to fend off all of these different fronts and potentially just be less money.
Because there are limits on how much you can give to a candidate, for instance.
Right, exactly. You cannot give $100 million directly to a candidate. Although you can take that $100 million and advertise on behalf of the candidate just without technically coordinating.
You can give it directly to the party in the form of soft money, too. But I think Molly's excellent point there is the Democratic spending is going to be focused very much on the presidential race, whereas a lot of the Republican spending is going to be focused on Congress. And that's where folks who are watching the Senate are wondering whether or not Republicans will be able to take back the Senate, because the spending on the Democratic side will not match up to the super PAC spending on the Republican side in the Senate. And in keeping some of those House seats, which frankly would probably be lost of, you know, that the Tea Party gained, shoring those up with super PAC money, because there will be no equal spending on the Democratic side to take them back.
Go ahead, Molly. Wanted to say something?
Yeah, that's a really good point, and I think that's especially going to be significant in the Senate and House races that are not in swing states, because you have big deal Senate races mm-hmm. in places like Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, that will not be contested at the presidential level. Potentially that's true of Missouri as well. But so the question is, do Republicans probably will have money to blitz those states just as much as the swing states. In the swing states, potentially it's much more of a factor of coattails for the Democratic and Republican nominees, because for Senate, because they'll just get swamped by all the presidential advertising.
Scott, you had mentioned that you feel like a lot of this negative either campaigning or ads or back and forth is to rally the base. And you also indicated you felt as if swing voters don't necessarily, or the independent voters don't necessarily play the role that perhaps we think they do. Can you expand on that?
Sure. We call it the myth of the independent voter, and it's there's really two ways of looking at this. There's this belief that independent voters are these well-informed people who weigh both sides very carefully and then make their decision. And that's just in general not true. Now, there are exceptions. Let me give you an example. Anybody who's listening to your program right now who is an independent is probably the exception, because they're an independent who is actually engaged in finding out more about politics. Most independents don't do that. Research shows that independents score lower on political knowledge tests than partisans on either side. They're not as engaged. They're not as likely to turn out. And so they usually are so tiny of a slice, they're not going to swing an election. When we measure partisanship, we ask, we rotate, but are you Democrat or Republican, an independent or something else? And then if they're a partisan, we go on to ask, are you a strong or not so strong partisan? And if they say they're an independent, we then ask, do you lean towards, and we rotate, Democratic Party, Republican Party, or neither? So you have this slice, and everybody says, oh, almost a third of the public are independents. In truth, the majority of those folks are leaners, meaning they lean towards one of the parties. And it's been shown time and time again that independents who lean towards one of the parties are actually more faithful voters for that party than people who say, oh, I'm a partisan, but a weak partisan. So the group we're talking about is this super slim margin who says, I'm an independent and I lean towards neither party, and they tend not to follow politics as closely, so they're harder to reach. So for them to swing an election is frankly a rarity. Elections usually hinge on driving out your base.
And Molly, we're almost up at a break here. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with any of that, except to say that in a close election, in an election that's potentially decided nationally by a point or two, even that tiny group in the middle does have the potential to swing it.
And, of course, depending on what state they live in.
Right.
And
that's the other thing.
That's the other thing. And we are talking about politics today in Radio Times, taking stock of the race to the White House. And our guests are Molly Ball. She's a staff writer, covers national politics for The Atlantic. Scott Huffman is an associate professor of political science and director of the Social and Behavioral Research Lab at Winthrop University. That's in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Also directs the Winthrop ETV Poll Initiative. We're curious about whether you're paying attention. Are you independent? Are you a leaner? Are you a Republican, a Democrat, something else? Give us a call. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Its magical images have delighted generations. In a concert for families, Yannick Nezet-Séguin leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in scenes from Disney's Fantasia, accompanied by the iconic film and original animated scenes on a giant screen. Mickey Mouse and the Sorcerer's Apprentice, Waltzing Flowers, and more. It's all part of the Stokowski Celebration. Tickets online or 215-893-1999. Saturday, June 23rd at the Academy of Music, Disney's Fantasia in concert.
Hey, I'm Jan.
I'm Robert.
We make the show Radiolab,
which is mostly a show just for your ears.
But not anymore. Because coming soon to the Kimmel Center's Academy of Music...
A very different kind of Radiolab.
Yeah, eyeballs dancing.
Astronauts sizzling.
Holy cow.
Blind men yelling.
Sultan, you are trying to impose a visual totalitarianism upon the human brain.
Join us for Radiolab Live June 29th. Details are at radiolab.org/inthedark.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. At Fox Chase, molecular medicine helps improve diagnostics for cancer patients. Using the genetic analysis of tumor cells, doctors readily identify the best use of existing cancer drugs and design more effective clinical trials. As DNA sequencing becomes more prevalent in cancer care, Fox Chase is committed to discovering how these methods can best help patients and lead to better outcomes. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking about presidential election politics today on the show with Molly Ball and with Scott Huffman. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Molly, let me go back to you. Before we get to our calls, you had an interesting piece in The Atlantic, the new nasty Obama campaign, basically saying that the lofty rhetoric of 2008 is gone and has been replaced by some more smash-mouth politics. Should that be surprising after 3.5 years on the job?
Well, possibly not. But I just think I wrote that piece because I thought it was worth taking a step back and remembering how much a part of Obama's brand this promise of civility and bipartisanship was. Now, you can make all kinds of explanations for this. I think, in large part, Obama has run up against a Republican intransigence that was stronger than he expected and that has maybe killed a little of his own hopefulness. And it's also true that he ran a campaign in 2008 that was not, you know, there were no kid gloves applied to Hillary Clinton or John McCain. But there was a very careful effort made to preserve this Obama brand. And you talk to Democrats, even through the 2010 election, the left was frustrated because they felt like he wasn't enough of a fighter. They felt like there was too much concern in the White House and among the sort of keepers of the Obama flame with preserving this notion of the president as this transformational figure who was above the fray and who had, you know, launched his political career with that 2004 speech about bringing together the blue states and the red states. And it really wasn't until last summer and the falling apart of the debt ceiling talks that I think the White House and Obama himself just said, okay, this isn't working. We've got to sort of drop this pretense, this fig leaf of being above it all and just get down in there and engage, or they're just going to keep beating us.
Well, and it's a different reality when you're the incumbent, you know, defending your record, and when you're the challenger from the outside who can offer things that haven't happened yet.
Sure. I mean, I do think there is something lost here, right? Because voters still, especially those voters who are not the hardcore base partisans, but who are just maybe tuning in now because they have better things to do with their lives.
Exactly.
Those voters still have a very strong sense of this idea of the president of hope and change. And you see this in focus groups, you see this in some polling, that there is a sense of disappointment that the president wasn't able to make that happen for whatever reason. So there's been a calculation made on the part of the Obama folks that even though this was an image that was helpful to them in some ways, they lost more than they gained from it, right? That by not engaging and by not giving as good as he got, he was taking too much off the table.
Scott, do you want to weigh in on that? Whether the sort of hopey, changey thing, I guess that was Sarah Palin who said that. I'm sorry to have said that on Radio Times. But nonetheless, it worked 4 years ago. I don't think it would work with anybody at this point.
I think Molly's elucidated why that happened. It hasn't been as effective. I think he's trying to pivot on his brand. That brand really did float him into office, and she's right. It is true that he wasn't playing with kid gloves. It was absolutely bare-knuckled. We saw it up close and personal here in South Carolina against Hillary Clinton. But, you know, he still had this incredible brand, and now, because that brand did not come across with the successes that he'd hoped, mainly because he was, you know, fighting a Congress that just couldn't have cared less about his brand, he is trying to pivot on that brand. The question is, what brand is he going to pivot to? Is it going to be the new Coke for him and blow up in his face, or is it something that voters are going to be able to latch on to and say, I believed in his message of hope and change, he wasn't able to execute that, and now he's going to fight hard for it. And if he can create that narrative arc, then people will buy into the new brand by evolving from the old. Otherwise, it might seem too jarring to folks who said, wait a minute, that guy I voted for 4 years ago and then didn't pay that close attention to, where's he?
Interesting. Let me get, looks like Stephanie from Germantown to join our conversation. And Stephanie, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Maybe your guest just really commented on what I was hoping for a comment from them about was why no candidates ever seem interested in running a clean campaign. With all the comments that they make about how they are different than Washington, wouldn't that alone be different from Washington?
And you're saying why don't candidates run, and by clean you mean like not nasty?
Yeah, like why, you know, it's all about, you know, bashing the other guy. And, mm-hmm. I mean, I turn my TV off when I see the ads, because I would much rather hear what the candidate actually wants for our country than what they think the other candidate doesn't want for our country, if that makes sense.
It does. If you don't mind, Scott, let me toss that back to you. You mentioned, you know, some interesting research by Drew West and looking at people's brains. Is it just this kind of visceral response people have to politics and to candidates that makes it so nasty?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, let me point out a couple of things. First off, your caller is very unique in the American public. In fact, because she's informed, because she pays attention to issues, the average voter is not nearly as informed and only has one or two issues that tug strongly at them. And we see these candidates that, you know, promise the moon when it comes to clean, above the board, no mudslinging campaigns, and they get a taste of power, or they want to get the taste of power, and they convince themselves that the ends justifies the means. I can be the good government person and fix all this if I can just get into power. So I have to play these dirty guys' game just to get into power. And I think there's a lot of justification that goes on. But it's also because of what lights up the partisan's brain. And the fact is, you cannot convince somebody who has spent a lot of time thinking, am I closer to this party or am I closer to that party? And they've come down on one side. You cannot win a fact-based argument with those folks, and this goes for strong Democrats and strong Republicans. And the reason is, as you're talking, their brain is working overtime to come up with reasons why you're wrong, or you're not to be believed, or you're not credible. So when you have a good, strong discussion of the issues, what's happening in the brain of true partisans is not weighing those facts, it is dismissing those facts. And that's why those are less likely to be out there, because that takes a lot more cognitive effort, and it's not as efficient at getting people to come and vote for you. It's easier with a 30-second attack ad saying why your opponent's such a scumbag.
Stephanie, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Molly, I don't want to bore our audience, but I do want to talk about some actual issues here, including jobs and
that's
the
problem. Issues are boring, right?
I know, exactly.
Conflict is much juicier.
And actually, you guys are fantastic. But at the same time, this whole notion of jobs and the economy, and there were some job numbers, or I guess unemployment numbers, out today. Is that the kind of barometer for how you think things will end up in November when all is said and done, no matter how sort of Neanderthal our brains are?
Well, certainly all the research points to the idea that people do sort of vote their gut in terms of how they think things are going. But that does still leave a lot of room for the campaigns to litigate, because, first of all, the economic situation has been very ambiguous. We have growth, so it's not totally in the toilet, but it's very slow and anemic and unsteady and tends to sort of yo-yo a little bit. And so I think people aren't sure how to feel about the economy and whether it's improving. Right. They're generally, there's a sense of sort of, I think, in the polling you see sort of long-range optimism, but at the same time people don't feel like things are going well. And so the campaigns, I think you see messaging very hard on the economy, because they're trying to persuade people either that things are going worse than they are and therefore the president has to be replaced, or that things are going better than you think, and if you just trust in the president, give him a little more time, they'll get even better. And so it is about the economy, but it's about how people feel about it. Right. the economy, and that's very uncertain at this point.
And that's Molly Ball. She's a staff writer covering national politics for The Atlantic. Joins us along with Scott Huffman from Winthrop University. That's in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Both of them joining us as we talk about the race to the White House, dissecting some of the issues, some of the campaign ideas, ads, money, all of that. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you want this campaign to be about? Scott, if I can go back to you, and I have to say that the most disturbing, survey that I read this week was from the Federal Reserve, that the median family's net worth dropped from $126,000 to $77,000 between the years 2007 and 2010. That's a 40% drop in a median middle-class family's net income. And to me, that seems...
I'm trying to remember, was it net income or net worth?
Net worth. So that includes houses.
Housing.
Yes. But nonetheless, that is a dramatic and frankly scary drop.
Oh, it absolutely is, and it's on the forefront of people's minds. Mm-hmm. We've been told for years and years that the American dream was to own your little plot of land, to own your own home, your own condo. And so people, worked hard to get that. A lot of minorities and low-income folks who had never had, a family that could help them, build up wealth, this is the first wealth that they've ever had, and they have been hit harder than many others. So a lot of Americans, buying into this American dream of owning our home, owning property, that property values could never go down. Well, when they did, and we had most of our net worth tied up in that house, it's had a dramatic effect, and it's left us unable to, for example, even move or take time and spend money on education to get a better job or a different job, which left us a little more unable to handle the recession as it came along. Mm-hmm. But back to something, Molly said, and this is why I love talking with good writers. What a phenomenal turn of a phrase that the campaigns will continue to litigate this, because it's exactly what's already happening. Both sides are coming out and pouncing on that, with the Obama side saying, hey, things aren't actually as bad as they seem, and the Romney saying, look at what you've lost under President Obama.
Well, we should say, if they're talking about these particular numbers, it's the end of the Bush administration, beginning of the Obama administration. But also, just to underscore the income drop, and I'll toss this to you, Molly, the income drop over that time period, median family income drop from $49,600 to $45,800, almost a $4,000 drop in that 2007 to 2010 period. Again, a very scary, a real reality check about how hard hit the middle class has been.
Absolutely. And a couple things, Scott touched on this as well. Almost all of the drop in net worth came from housing, and almost all of it came in 2007 and 2008, during the crash. And so this is another one of those factors where you have the president struggling to say, look, this all happened before I came into office. This wasn't on my watch. And you did see, there was a Gallup poll the other day, 70% of Americans still blame Bush more than Obama for what's happened. But they don't like the idea, I don't think, that he is avoiding blame. And this is why you hear from Republicans all the time that the president is making excuses, that he refuses to take responsibility, or that even if Bush did cause all of this, Obama should have been able to do more to turn it around, and hasn't made enough progress from that low point we hit 4 years ago.
Scott, let me quote something that Thomas Friedman wrote, picking up on what Molly just said. And he said, Barack Obama is a great orator, but he is the worst president I've ever seen when it comes to explaining his achievements, putting them in context, connecting with people on a gut level through repetition, and thereby defining how the public views an issue. You think he's right about that?
Well, this is the law professor in him coming out. He's much more used to a kind of a Socratic method. And then when he went into politics, you couldn't do that. But lengthy explanations of his beliefs and ideas were how he began to approach things, especially in his senatorial career. And that is not how you connect with voters. Voters like the average voter, not informed voters, but the average voter needs to connect at a gut, visceral level. It's something that often conveys a meaning that is poorly defined, frankly. It's morning in America. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah.
It's you know, we take all these phrases, and it has to do with Obama's brand. He's very smart, but that sometimes works against him when he, you know, goes too far in explaining his points. Voters need to feel comfortable, warm, and powerfully connected. And sometimes, if you're in politics, if you're explaining, you're losing. So they need to feel an immediate, visceral connection without having to have it explained to them.
Those pesky facts. Now go ahead, Molly.
Yeah, and I think this is an interesting factor in this election that neither of the nominees is a warm and fuzzy guy, and both campaigns are painting the other as out of touch. You know, the Romney campaign saying Obama is disconnected from the problems of everyday Americans, or he's in a bubble, or he's in denial about how bad things really are. Especially saying last week that the private sector is doing fine, and then having to take that back a little bit. They're saying, look, he thinks things are going okay. He thinks that you're not suffering out there. And then the Obama campaign, of course, saying this is a guy who has umpteen houses and an elevator for his cars and has never had to struggle in his whole life, born with a silver spoon, etc. And so he can't possibly know what it's like to struggle the way Americans are struggling. I think there's an element of truth to both of those arguments, and it means that voters who really are looking for that emotional sustenance that Scott's talking about, that sense of connection to a politician, or just that sense that there's someone who represents a steady hand who can sort of ease their anxiety. I don't think there's a lot of that to be found in this presidential race.
But is that having the beer with the president idea? I mean, is that what we're talking about here, Molly?
I think it's slightly different. I think if we're going to locate it in a political trope of the last couple of decades, it would be the Clinton feel your pain thing.
The idea that I empathize with you and
right. The idea that on a sort of gut level, these candidates sort of have been there and know what you're going through.
What do you think, Scott?
I think it's absolutely right. When people feel that their leaders are disconnected, that leads to a lack of political efficacy, a lack of, you know, the feeling that you matter politically. And when they feel disconnected, they just sort of tune out. And right now, a lot of voters are saying, I'm not sure either of these guys really understands what I am personally going through. But it's bigger than that. It's them and their friends, because, you know, we talk about people being pocketbook voters, but in reality, it's not so much they vote their own wallet, they vote their perception. This is something Molly said earlier. They vote their perception of the economy, and people are actually pretty prescient at figuring out what's happening in the economy. If you track unemployment data and you track economic trends, you can see that preceding that, people's opinions of how the economy is doing actually accurately precedes the actual economy. Now, this is any individual is going to be way off, but when you take it on average, people have a generally good idea of how things for them and people like them are doing. And so when they vote, they're sociotropic pocketbook voters. They vote for how they feel the economy is doing for them and people like them. They want to know that a candidate understands that, and Mitt Romney seems, you know, entirely removed from that, and a lot of people feel Obama can't connect with their lives either. So, you know, one or both of them is going to have to find a way to get in to the average voter's life and say, I understand this, I get this, I can help you.
Well, we are putting the candidates on a couch here today on Radio Times, talking with Scott Huffman and Molly Ball. Molly is a staff writer covering national politics at The Atlantic. Scott Huffman is associate professor of political science, director of the Social and Behavioral Research Lab at Winthrop University in South Carolina, directs the Winthrop ETV Poll Initiative. It's a polling initiative collecting data about how the American South feels about political developments. We want to know how you feel about political developments. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We'll take more calls after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY, an affiliate of the Penn Cancer Network. They offer access to complex treatment options, clinical trials, a multidisciplinary team approach to care, and helpful nurse navigators. ChesterCountyHospital.org.
The Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University, offers a season of diverse ideas, world perspectives, and thought-provoking conversation, featuring seven engaging evenings at the Kimmel Center with a stellar lineup of speakers that includes two former presidents, a powerhouse economic authority, an award-winning author, a miracle survival story, and more. Information on the complete lineup of speakers is available at PhiladelphiaSpeakerSeries.org, sponsored by WHYY.
Join WHYY and NewsWorks at the Michener Art Museum on Saturday, June 23rd for To Stir, Inform, and Inflame, The Art of Tony Auth. Enjoy a private lunch and lecture with Tony Auth and curator David Leopold, followed by a self-guided tour. Featuring 150 original drawings, the exhibition explores Auth's dynamic digital work. To register, visit whyy.org/events. The exhibit runs through October 21st. Visit MichenerArtMuseum.org.
Supporting WHYY, Focus Features, presenting the new film Moonrise Kingdom, directed by Wes Anderson, and starring Bruce Willis, Edward Norton, Bill Murray, Frances McDormand, and Tilda Swinton. Moonrise Kingdom, in select theaters now.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are taking stock of the race for the White House in this hour of the show, examining how the presidential candidates are faring, and that would be President Obama and Governor Romney, talking with Scott Huffman and also talking with Molly Ball. And just wanted to open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Elaine from Exton to join us on Radio Times. Elaine, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling to say that I think that America is more than one-dimensional. We need somebody in the White House that's able to deal not only with the economy, but also with the other issues that are happening in America today. Our standing among the European countries and other parts of the world, ability to handle the warlike conditions that are coming along, the civil rights problems that are occurring in America right now. So I don't think it's one person. I think we need somebody. We need to look at somebody that has more than that going for them than just one thing.
Fair enough, Elaine. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Molly, it's a long list of responsibilities for the current president, whoever the next president is going to be.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, there's a lot to deal with. There was a lot to deal with 4 years ago. But at the same time, you don't hear these candidates talking about a really multifaceted agenda because it is all about the economy. I think people feel that the economy needs to be at the center of everything. And once you take care of that, then you can maybe get to dealing with other stuff. You haven't heard either of these candidates propose a really lengthy agenda. And they've both taken some criticism for that. People saying, what are we going to get out of an Obama second term? You know, the campaign 4 years ago was very much about universal health care and ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he would say, well, that it's because we accomplished those things that now we can't run on them. But it's also true that people felt like some of the agenda from 4 years ago maybe distracted the president from focusing solely on getting the economy to recover. And so for that reason as well, you've had Romney saying, I will be focused only on jobs and everything else will be secondary.
Go ahead, Scott.
Something systemic about the way we elect the president in the United States of America. You have to remember, a lot of countries have a head of state and a head of government. Head of government is often the prime minister. And so when a prime minister, who the people in most countries that have one don't elect, the prime minister, you know, wants that position, he has to lay out an agenda with tons and tons of policy issues. Now, the head of state is usually ceremonial. For example, in Britain, it's the Queen, so it's God Save the Queen. But in America, it's the head of state and the head of government are the same person. So even though their job will be supremely political, as in, you know, by God, why can't that idiot do anything right? The election they run in is to become our national symbol. And so our head of state runs a campaign saying, I'm the guy you want standing up in front of the world, standing up for you. I'm the symbol you want, even though the job they must take is one that is supremely political. So it's part of it is the nature in America where we combine head of state and head of government and run one election for it. That kind of changes the way we talk about who we're voting for. Than it would if we were simply electing someone who is going to be our chief politician.
And Scott, do you think the public thinks the president has more kingly or queenly powers than he does?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that the public always unfairly lays blame and unfairly gives credit to the president for whatever happens. Ever since the Employment Act of 1946, the president has had more of a direct role in governing the ship of the economy. But whatever happens with the economy, the president takes direct blame or direct credit in a way that's exaggerated. So folks do assume that a president can come in and change everything, and when they prove unable to do so, that can backfire, which I think goes to our earlier point of people elected Obama saying we hope for change, we want hope and change, and when he was unable to deliver, these people who are not as familiar with the political system are upset with the guy they voted for. And of course the Democrats want to say no, don't be mad at him, be mad at Congress, but in their gut they didn't get what they expected, because you're right, they over expect what the power of the president can truly do.
Well, let me get Matt in on this, and Molly, I'll put his comment or question to you. It's related to what we were just talking about. Matt from Glen Mills, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. So my question was, how much power does the president actually have over the direction that the economy goes in?
A very direct question. Go ahead, Molly. Take that.
Sure. It's debatable, I guess. That's not a very satisfying answer. But there's a number of things that the president does that don't require Congress to act on legislation, that the president does do directly. And so these are the things you hear Romney, for example, promising he would change on day one, saying that he would greenlight the Keystone Pipeline and that he would immediately start cutting regulations and start issuing executive orders to waivers for Obamacare. So there are a lot of sort of regulatory things and executive branch actions that the president takes, appointments and things like that, the federal agencies and all of that. So I think there is a pretty direct impact. But the other thing that I wanted to jump in on, sure, what Scott was saying before, which was such an excellent point, we certainly do expect or give too much, ascribe too much power to the presidency. But one thing that the president does have direct control over that I think is going to be sort of a sleeper issue that is going to play a bigger role in possibly a few weeks in this campaign is Supreme Court appointments, because you're going to have the Supreme Court come out with a decision on Obamacare and also a big political decision on the Arizona immigration law. And both of those are issues that will fire up both party bases to a very large extent. And those are things that the president, I think you'll have both sides saying to their partisans, look, you've got to make sure that you elect this guy, if for no other reason than that you get a court that either does or does not make these kinds of decisions, depending on what they decide.
Matt, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Judith from Medford has to say. And Judith, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, sorry, I'm in the car, so it's kind of hard.
Go ahead.
This is so informative. My issue has always been, I think the American voters are just stupid. But they're really not. They just aren't listening. And you kind of answered the question that I had earlier about why is it that everything is lumped on the president's shoulders, yet we have a Congress and a Senate who have blocked everything. And I would like to know how come, I kind of changed my question because you answered some of it, but how come Americans focus so strongly on the president without thinking about the underlying foundation of our government, like your speaker said, the Supreme Court, the Congress that enacts the laws, all these things are of a piece, but American voters don't seem to get that. Is there a psychological reason for that?
Well, Judith, I don't know. We don't have a psychologist here, but we have Scott Huffman, who's been talking a lot about interesting brain research. But I wonder whether, more than that, we need a civics lesson so that we understand how our government is at least supposed to work.
Oh, I absolutely think we all need a civics lesson. I'm a firm believer that keeps me employed in teaching American government. So
conflict of interest there for you, isn't it?
Exactly.
Very glad that she said the American public is not stupid. They are not. But they are only partially attentive, and they like to take heuristic shortcuts, cognitive shortcuts, where they say, okay, in general, I can pick the side that I usually believe with without thinking too deeply about this issue, because I need to think about my job and getting food on the table and whoever is in my favorite TV program. Sorry, I could have thrown out a better reference.
That's
I don't watch
okay.
that much TV. Sorry.
That's
but
okay.
So we use our brains for other things. And when it comes to ascribing blame, she said something interesting. Why are people not pointing the finger at Congress? And if she could sort of take the mind of an opposite partisan view for a second, the Republicans are looking at that saying, thank God Congress is standing up to this, you know, add your label, socialist, whatever they want to call Obama this week. And so, you know, they are ascribing too much power to the president, too, but there's this thin bulwark protecting America, and it's Congress standing up against this president, and they need to reinforce it. So it's all part of the meta-narrative that partisans get into, but the truth is people don't understand the checks and the balances. They were sleeping or thinking about the boy or girl in the chair in front of them in high school civics class. And it would really help if people understood those things a lot better, but that doesn't play out in the American public very often.
Well, Molly, let me segue from that to voter turnout, and we see obviously in off year elections, voter turnout is shockingly low. But even in high profile campaigns, I mean, if you get 60%, 70%, 80%, that's pretty unusual. Does that tell us that voters they just don't think that politics and government matters in their life?
Well, the majority of people do vote, so certainly more people could, and more people have sometimes in the past. But people vote when they feel like they have to, when they feel like something's at stake. And for all that we hear about every single time we hear this is the most important election of our lifetimes, it probably isn't,
right?
The election right before the Civil War was probably more important. And so if people feel like they have something personally on the line, I mean, another thing that you will see, that you always see during a general election, is both candidates sort of try to run toward the middle and shave off the hard partisan edges, is they are both trying to convince people that you know, my opponent is a crazy right winger, but I am certainly not a leftist, or vice versa. So I think a lot of voters may look at the two candidates and say, well, I don't see that much difference. I see them both saying that they'd kind of, you know, keep a steady hand on the tiller, and you know, they're trying to create differences that maybe aren't that plausible. And so part of the reason that you have these campaigns being so aggressive is because they're trying to create bigger differences than may actually exist.
And they're trying to run away from their own narrative. I mean, Molly hit something really important there. I call it the two constituencies problem. In your primary, you're running hard to the right, hard to the left, saying, I'm the most far right, I'm the most far left. And then all of a sudden you're saying, no, I was kidding about all that. I'm here in the middle with you, the average voter who didn't bother voting in that primary. It's no wonder we're politically schizophrenic in this country when we have people who win elections by saying they're more extreme during part of the year and the most moderate during another part of the year, and people who don't pay that close attention to politics are rightly confused.
Well, let me see what Susan from Bryn Mawr has to say. And Susan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I wanted to comment on, you know, the way I see this is that reporters and people who don't pay attention are not looking at how Romney's policies will impact people. They're talking about global kinds of things and what he'll do, but they're not talking about his signing on to the Ryan plan and how his policies will impact working people in this country, middle class people in this country, and how it's going to impact Wall Street and big business. I don't understand why people are not talking about that.
But are you blind?
Why are they not paying attention?
Susan, let me just ask you a question. Do you think that's the responsibility of the press or the responsibility of the Obama campaign to raise those issues?
I think it's the responsibility of the press because they're there to ask questions. He won't even appear on these programs to be asked the questions. He won't answer the questions.
Well, Molly,
I think that is the responsibility of the press. That's what they're there for, to ask the questions.
But
he's asking for 4 years, and nobody knows how his policies, the policies that he has said that he's going to sign on to, he needs to be questioned about that.
Well, fair enough. Molly Ball, your thoughts?
Well, I'm just wondering how the caller knows all these things if the press has been so systematically censoring them and preventing the public from knowing them. I mean, the fact is, I get this a lot from both sides, and people tend to think that the media is not reporting things, but the things they think the media is not reporting are, in fact, things that they have learned from the media. I think there's been extensive reporting on where Romney stands on the Ryan plan and the debate over what the Ryan plan would do to the economy, which is a debate about predicting the future, so nobody actually knows, but you certainly have a very lively speculation on both sides of whether this would be a good or bad thing if this were to pass and were to be implemented. There's been a lot of reporting about trying to project forward the different economic visions of these candidates. It is true that Romney has not been as accessible to the press as I think we would like a candidate to be, as we'd like especially a challenger to be. And you do see him starting to open up a little bit. In fact, this Sunday, he's going on Face the Nation, being interviewed by Bob Schieffer. So I think that, you know, a fantastic interview, should be tough, and it'll be very interesting to see what he gets asked.
And I wonder, too, Scott, whether when you look at where the public gets their news, we're talking in many ways about not like segregated by law, but the people gravitate to the news that kind of reinforces what they believe anyway.
That's absolutely true. They go to those because it reinforces what they believe, and because it reinforces what they believe, they say this must be a credible news outlet because it told me what I already knew and it reaffirmed that. And so we do end up going to sources that we view as more credible, and we choose them as being more credible because they say things we tend to agree with, so we know they must be correct. Molly's right, though. There are a lot of tax institutes and places like this that have done these analyses, but they are out there. They are dry. People do have to look for them. It's very hard to congeal in a simple, engaging narrative. I think the Obama administration tried to do this and sort of failed. Didn't they have some online fictitious person, I forgive me for forgetting the name, that you were
Julia.
Supposed to click on and find out how things would affect her, and they wanted to make it this sort of interactive thing that you could play with, and it ended up, I think, flopping a little bit, but doing that, I think, was addressing this very problem, how to get people to understand how policies might affect them. Those things are out there. They often come from policy institutes that do this analysis. They're reported on in the press, but a lot of times you have to dig for the better analysis rather than the 30-second blurb on the evening news.
Well, we have to end, but we'll have to have you two back together again. It was a great pleasure. Molly Paul, thanks for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
And Scott Huffman, thank you for joining us as well.
Been my pleasure.
Molly Ball, staff writer covering national politics at The Atlantic, joined us from their studios. And Scott Huffman is with the Winthrop University in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. You can also check us out online. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.